loading you guys. I'm K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. At this time, it's in the deck net, as we've done for lots of years, since 1982. The main purpose of the tech net is education. Amateurs develop all kinds of experience by touching their antennas, building antennas, trying out various kinds of antennas, transmitters, receivers, feed lines, and so on, propagation mode, the 30 or so kinds of ham radio. They try them out and get on the air and teach each other what they learn and how to make things work better. TechNet is broken up into three sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. They give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning they do have a question or a comment. You need to sign in to say you're listening. After all these years, we believe somebody's listening. That's already been proven. The second section is where Dr. Roy, AC2GS, gives us the science talk and the mailbag. And so he's usually got some interesting puzzles and things like that to pass along. The third section is by Paul, WS2N, who gives us a space report and tells us what NASA and all the other space agencies in the world are doing. Let me drop. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins. If you do have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and your name. Try to remember to give me your name. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So if you've got a question or a comment, please sign in right now. K2RIW listening.
W-A-2-N, say why, Doug.
Very fine, Doug. Okay, we got Doug. Anyone else?
K2RLW. Bob.
Very fine, we got you, Bob. So we got Doug and Bob. Anyone else to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and your name, just like those guys did, right now.
WB2GXM, Rich, and yes.
Very fine, Rich. GXM, okay. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now if you want to check in, because you do have a question or a comment for the net. One last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we're going to go over to Doug. Doug, are you coming in on the Eastern input? You sound very good tonight. Haven't heard from you in a long time. How are all those antennas on your roof hanging out? The B2SAY. Better known as 20 dB McGarrett. K2RIW. Go ahead, Doug.
Hey, Isaac and everybody else out over there. Actually, I don't have the antenna on the roof. I have the antenna. It's a, I guess it's a Cushcraft. It's about 8 foot long. It's a vertical. It's on a tripod in the backyard. And a whole slew of coax from wherever it is to where I am, which is in the house in the dining room. Anyway, I was going to mention the Nano VNA. I don't know whether anybody out there has got one. I got one. And it's been too cold to go out there and connect it to my 2-meter antenna and see how it's doing. Apparently it's doing very well, but I really wanted to see whether I could get it a little bit better. I had to back in the bag the sweep generator and a scope and what do they call it? A directional coupler kind of device that they try to optimize the SWR on the antenna. And I guess I did a reasonable job, but it was a pain in the ass. This is a really interesting little gadget, but like I say, it's too cold right now to take it out and try it in real life. Back to net right now.
If you know the length of your transmission line, Doug, and if you know the insertion loss that you can look up, you can make all those measurements with a VNA on the shack end of a transmission line, and if you're smart enough, you can interpret those results as to what's really happening right at the antenna itself. So when you go out there, If you did it outdoors, you're still going to have a short length of transmission line between that voltage network analyzer, VNA, vector network analyzer, and the antenna. So in either case, you're getting some amount of translating taking place by way of the insertion loss and the delay of the transmission line. If you're using a Smith chart recording, display, for instance, you're getting a certain amount of rotation of the Smith chart based on the length of the transmission line. And there's ways you can crank that back out. So if you're smart enough, you can make the measurements from the shack. You get a little bit more error, but it'll certainly tell you what's going on. And that micro vector network analyzer you've got, what brand name, how many dollars, how long have you had it? Sounds like you're pretty happy with it. W2SAY, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick and the guys. It's called a nano VNA. I think it's been out actually since about the spring, but I found out about it, in September. And I just got it a couple of days ago. I guess it comes directly from China. I don't know, but it's ridiculously small. It's about the size of a pack of cigarettes. It has two ports. I guess you can use it for S21 as well as S11. And yes, it does Smith charts, and it does big VSWR over a range. It has a frequency range of, I think, 10 megahertz to 900 megahertz. So it misses the 903 band. Hello, I think I got a problem with the battery here. Let's see if I'm still on the air. WA2SAY, back to net.
Yeah, don't worry, Doug, you're still on the air. Is your battery getting low? Go ahead. You're running on a handy talkie?
I have a handy talkie here, and it started the red light started to flash on and off, which I couldn't do because the thing has been on charge for the last couple of weeks. Anyway, that's the deal with it. I wanted to kind of discuss with anybody else that has one of these things, how they're getting along with it and so forth. The first thing I've noticed with it is that the charging jack seems to be it has no polarity. You can plug the cable in wrong, but it doesn't charge if you do. And sometimes you plug it in, it doesn't charge anyway. So there's a mechanical problem with the charging jack. And all I have done so far is just check it with the 50 ohm loads and the short and the open, and the Smith chart looks correct. So that's all I know. At the moment, I haven't taken it out, and I don't know how long the feed line is, but there's lots of it. There's quite a bit of loss here between me and the antenna at the moment. WA2SAY, back to net.
Very fine, Doug. This micro VNA, how did you find it? You're probably looking at a website. What does it cost? And it sounds like it's doing a pretty good job. I presume you hook it up to a laptop in order to do the display. Is that true, Doug? Go ahead.
Like, it's not. You can hook it up to a laptop, but you don't have to. It's got a little, maybe 2-inch by 3-inch touch screen display right on it. As I say, it's about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and it's got a touch screen display, and you can at least theoretically set up all your parameters just by touching it with your finger.
Very fine. What does the thing cost, Doug? And do you have to tell it what frequency range you're scaling?
It's NANO. Capital VNA, nano VNA. I assume you can look that up on. I forget how I found out about it, but it sounded like a good idea to me, so I bought one.
What does it cost, Doug?
$50, give or take a couple of bucks.
And it gets shipped from China. Now, one of the things you could do to test out it nicely would be to take a pair of 50-ohm terminations, put them onto a T-connector, put the two terminations on two of the output ports of the T-connector, put the input port to the DNA, and you should measure a known amount of reflection coefficient, which I think is minus 9.5 dB or so, and a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That would be a fun test to do. A pair of terminations on a T-connector. Over to you, Doug, KQLIW.
Interesting idea, Dick. I don't think I have an SMAT. The connectors on this thing are SMA, and it comes with a couple of little short, about 6 inches long, 50-ohm cables, and a couple of loads that comes up, I guess, a short, an open, and a 50-ohm termination, all SMA, and a female-to-female SMA bullet. I have some SMA gadgets myself, but I'm not sure I have a T. I have to look and see.
The T-connector doesn't have to be an SMA. You can put an adapter from SMA to BNC or Type N, and then a BNC a T or a Type N T. Don't worry about the insertion loss of the adapter, Doug. Adapters, everybody thinks they're terrible. They're really beautiful. Because an adapter is only a fraction of an inch long, and as far as number of wavelengths is concerned, even if the adapter was made of 25-ohm cable, because it's only an inch long, you know, a 20th of a wavelength, it's not going to really do anything. And what it does is calculatable, if you know what I mean. So you could adapt from SMA to anything else you've got where you've got T-connectors and run that test. To B2SAY, K2IW.
That's a good idea, Dick. And I will get around to that one of these days, probably in the next couple of days, and see how it all works out. I gotta get used to this thing. One of the things that sort of peripheral to the situation, because of the touchscreen and the size of it, which is very small. Let me see if I got anything to measure it with right here. No, I don't, but I'll come back with something to measure it with. It's quite small, anyway. It's quite a bit smaller than a cell phone. And I was going to bring up... I wonder if anybody listening here knows about touchscreen pens which have more or less of a point on the end. Because I have... a couple of gadgets which I see if I can get back on the air again. I have a gadget here with kind of a big round ball type thing on the end to use with a cell phone to try and, you know, dial telephone numbers and stuff with. And but it's big and clumsy. I really need, and in my bank they have. Boy, I wonder if anybody knows where you can get something like that. W-A-2-S-A-Y, back to Ned.
So you're looking for a finer pointer that you could have on the end of a pen that's intended for a touchscreen to give you better resolution on the fine print of a touchscreen. Or we'll open that to the net to see if anybody knows where you can get one of those. I know there are certain kinds of ballpoint pens that have an end like that, that when you retract the ballpoint, the end acts as a pointer. My wife's got some of those, but I don't know what brand name they are, and I don't know where she got them from. Now, if you know, for instance, and there's ways you can measure, or since you know the brand name and roughly the number of feet of transmission line, you can estimate the number of dB of insertion loss. And standing wave ratio really is reflection coefficient. If you know you've got 5 dB of loss in your cable, and you measure a signal that's minus 15 dB of reflection coefficient, you know that the 5 dB occurred on the way out and on the signal on the way back, so 10 dB is from your cable round trip, and the 15 dB that you measure reflection coefficient on the antenna would mean that 5 dB of it is the antenna, and that would allow you to calculate the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. And whether or not it's tuned high or low, when you sweep it with an XY plot and look at the bottom of the bathtub, you'll know where it's tuned. So there's various ways that you can do all the evaluation, if you're smart enough, from the shack. with a vector network analyzer, Doug. It doesn't have to be right at the antenna itself, just as long as you know something about the cable. W-H-O-S-A-Y, drag your feet in case somebody knows a better way of getting one of these pointers for a touchscreen. K-2-R-I-W, listening.
W-A-2-C-D-L, there may be information on that.
Okay, I heard W-2-A-S-C and W-A-2-C-D-L. I think it's W-A-2-A-S-C. Alpha Sierra Charlie, start up with your name and your information. And correct me if I got the call letters wrong. A-S-C, go ahead.
No, Dick, you got the call letters correct, and I can confirm. I actually have one of those devices, and the retractable bullet point pen works perfectly fine on it.
Yeah, what brand name and where do you get it? And what's your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Name is Tony, and I just use a regular retractable ballpoint pen that I just happen to have in the drawer, and it works fine. Nothing special. Over.
Yeah, they sell a kind which has got a small felt-like ball at the end. Let's see what Andy's got to say. W-A-2-C-D-L, T-2-I-W. Go ahead, Andy. You got one of those, and where'd you get it? And what a cost.
Hi, good evening, Dick. No, I don't have one, but I was just at Staples. And I was looking for something, and I believe that walking down one of the aisles, I saw those type of pens that are used for touch screens being sold, like in a package of five or four or three, something like that. I believe Staples sells those items. That's what I'm saying.
That makes a lot of sense that they would have that. So Staples got it. Hopefully Doug has got a Staples somewhere near his neighborhood. So, as you can see, Doug, when you make measurements from the shack with a vector network analyzer, as long as you've got an estimation of the insertion loss, and you could measure the insertion loss of your cable, you know, end to end, you can take the data you get from the shack and translate it as to what's really happening at the antenna. And the main thing you want to know is what's the magnitude of reflection coefficient. And once you know that the signal has been through the cable twice, it's a round trip to come back to the VNA, you can figure out with reasonable accuracy what is the reflection coefficient of the antenna, and therefore what is its VISWAR. W-A-2-S-A-Y, T-2-R-A-W.
C-2-G-S?
Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you, Dick. I don't have one. I know someone who does have it. Its range is usually rated at 50 kilohertz to 900 megahertz, and the digital display is about 2.8 inches. The thing about the touch-sensitive screen, we kind of talked about this about a year ago here. There's two types of touch screens. There's resistive and capacitive. Most cell phones are capacitive. They're quick to respond, lively. But they tend to need either those round foam carbon tips or a battery powered stylus that's able to transfer the capacitance signal into a tight point. What this device probably is a resistive touch screen. All you need to do is apply pressure. You don't have to have any conducting electricity capacitance and such. So any pointy object, a ballpoint pen will do, a plastic pointy pencil-like device will do, any of those.
Even a very large toothpick or a piece of wooden dowel that's used for making shish kebab, skewing, would that work to your knowledge? Go ahead, Roy.
It's just a matter of being able to apply the right pressure, whereas capacitive screens work off of capacitive effect of your fingers. Resistive screens are simply two membranes that if you press them tightly together, they make contact and give off a reading. So if you can apply the right amount of pressure to a small point, then they'll work.
And you believe the small screen on this micro VNA is that kind that just requires pressure and not capacitance. Is that what you're saying?
The Yeah, I mean, most small electrical non-cell phones tend to be like this. Most ham radios that are touch-sensitive are all resistive, as far as I'm aware. It's very infrequent to see any capacitive. And the fact that the other gentleman is able to use it with a ballpoint pen pretty much puts the bow on it.
So it looks like you need a very large toothpick, Doug, and do an experiment to see if that'll allow you to address your screen. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
K-2-R-I-W in the net, this is W-A-2-S-A-Y. Okay, thanks a lot, guys. It's, I will certainly have to try that business with the large toothpick or whatever it is. That would help a lot. I have a lot of trouble with cell phones because I got fumble fingers and I can't seem to get the numbers right. But this thing with something like a ballpoint pen would be really helpful. And I will play around with it a little bit more in the next week. And so, particularly if it gets a little bit warmer and I go outside. And I'll report back as soon as I get some information. Thanks a lot, everybody. WA2SAY, I'll be clear and listening.
Doug, you've got nothing to lose if you make some measurements with your VNA from the shack side of the transmission line. Have you tried that? And it's not that difficult to interpret the results as to what you're seeing. Go back to you, Doug.
I understand that. The main thing is I have no idea how long a transmission line is between here and there, except that I'm pretty sure it loses about 3-4 dB en route.
That's not very much. So let's assume that your transmission line has got 4 dB of loss. That means the first 8 dB is a given. And so if you measure minus 5 dB of reflection coefficient, it would mean that the real reflection coefficient of your antenna is the difference between the 5 and the 8, or 3 dB, if you know what I mean. So it's not that difficult to interpret from the shack what's going on if you've got a rough approximation of what is the insertion loss of the transmission line. Now, the length of the transmission line, yes. That could rotate your Smith chart so that what looks like an inductor is really a capacitor, or what looks like a low resistance is a high resistance. So not knowing the length means that where your dot is on the Smith chart might not be accurate. But the first thing you want to know about is the reflection coefficient. Whether the antenna is capacitive or inductive is really kind of academic. Knowing the reflection coefficient, which is its VSWR and how well it's tuned, is really what I think you want to know. Does that make some sense, Doug? W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
As I say, when I first put the thing up, it was in my garage for several years before I put it up back here in the on a little tripod in the backyard. I brought out a sweep generator and a rotector and a scope, and I tuned it as well as I could as far as the reflection coefficient. So it's close, I imagine. But I'm just curious as to where it really is. So anyway, it's working. This is what I'm talking to you with. Anyway, WA2SAY back to that. Thanks a lot, guys.
WA2VDH with a comment on this subject.
VDH, start off with your name and then give us your comment.
Yeah, fine business. Name is John, handle is John. I just wanted to make a comment about the SMA connectors, the adapters going from SMA, especially to the larger connectors like N. I've heard of stories where SMA connectors on HTs, for example, if you try to put an adapter on them, to be very careful with the mechanical strain that the larger adapter can transfer to the smaller SMA connector. Sometimes you can get a lot of mechanical strain. You can actually damage the mounting of that connector. So just be a little easy on the adapters as far as the mechanical strain that it's putting on the mount. Go ahead.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, John, because the SMA is a small connector and it can't take very much. Doug, you're sounding quite good. Are you going through the eastern input at Selden? Is that how you're communicating with us? The B2SAY, K2RIW?
I'm going through the Selden repeater. Just on a, just as a comment to the last comment, some years ago I bought a an SWR gadget in a little plastic box with a goddamn UHF connector on it. And, of course, when I went to unscrew the cable that it was connected to, the thing twisted off and busted the plastic thing. I hate UHF connectors. I wish somebody in the world, and maybe in ARRL headquarters or something, would just standardize on type N for everything, or B and C for everything below, say, 200 megahertz or whatever. I hate those things. Back to Ned.
Yeah, that so-called UHF connector, though, Doug, is going to be with us for a long time. Mechanically, it's quite strong. The semiconductor being as large as it is, it can easily take a kilowatt of power without overheating. Yes, it is not the right impedance, and yes, it is not weatherproofed. And there's a lot of ways that they can give you some mechanical grief. But the standing wave ratio impact of a UHF connector, if you're below 1296, it's not there. It's only an inch long, if you know what I mean. At 432, an inch is a wavelength is 27 inches, so something an inch long has very little impact on standing wave ratio. So because it's so inexpensive, and as if properly mounted, and if it's of a reasonable brand name, it is a rugged connector on the back end of a radio. By the way, when it comes to the SMA connector you've got on your micro VNA, if one of your cables is flexible where the VNA connector on one end, and then you put the adapter on the other end, the flexibleness of the cable will stop your large type N or type BNC or whatever, a T connector, from creating any strain on your micro VNA. The flexibility of the cable will take that up. To B2SAY for any comments, K2RIW.
Yes, I do have these little cables, and yes, you're absolutely right about taking the strain off the VNA. My problem with UHF connectors is they just suck. They really do. You can it's next impossible to get them actually lined up and screwed on because the sawtooth or whatever you call it on the round end, it just doesn't want to light up. I just hate these things, and you can use them if you want, but every device I have in the shack has got an adapter to either BNC or type N, and I never use UHF to anything, period. WA2SAY.
Yeah, the biggest failure of a UHF is that it takes some mechanical finesse to properly engage those sorties before you screw down the outer coupling. And they are not weatherproofed. So to weatherproof it outdoors is a bit of a pain. So, but it is a rugged connector. Properly installing a UHF connector is a bit of an art form. You've got to tin the braid first before you screw on the appropriate piece of the UHF connector. And therefore, you'll have to screw it on with pliers. And when you do it that way, though, and then you use a big enough soldering iron through the hole, you do get a very good mechanical joint. If you don't tin it ahead of time, then the amount of solder you got to pour in there and the amount of melting you do of your dielectric material becomes excessive. So there are ways of installing a UHF connector. The male connector on the end of a piece of RG8U, for instance, cable. Each of these connectors are a bit of an art form. To properly install a type N connector takes me about 10 minutes. But once you spend the time doing it, if you do a good job of it, the connector will last you for a number of years, even outdoors. We're going to go over to the next person who signed in, which was Bob, K2 Romeo Lima Whiskey. You've got it, Bob. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. Yes, this is K2RLW, Bob in Hackensack. And I was looking for an update on how things are on the 1288 repeater and also 1296 in general. I have an ICOM 9700 here. That's very useful on the two lower bands of the three bands it's supposed to work on. But I have never been able to have a contact on 1296 or heard anything there. So I was wondering how the repairing of the repeater is doing and what my hope is for the near future. Go ahead, Dick. This is K2RLW. Bye.
Yeah, I'd like to believe that Andy might have an answer to that. To B2CDL, what's the status of the LIMOC 23-centimeter repeater, the 1288 repeater? What's the status? To B2CDL, commercial driver's license. To B2CDL, K2RLW. Go ahead, Andy, if you're there.
All right, Dick. Yeah, I'm here. You know, interestingly enough, I had a discussion today in regard to the antenna situation up at Glen Oaks. And I'm not going to get into all the details. And it has to do with the static that we hear, that we've been hearing on the repeater. My understanding right now, but it's not been confirmed, I'm going to find out this coming week. I'm going to be meeting with the manager of the site so we can hopefully get to the bottom of the static situation. I was informed, but again, it's not confirmed, that the antenna at Glen Oaks, which is used for this repeater, this 1.2 gig repeater, the 1296 repeater, has been temporarily replaced with another antenna as a spare for this repeater, for VHF. I believe that's what was mentioned. Again, it's not been confirmed, and I'm going to find out more information. The bottom line is, right now, according to what was mentioned, there is no antenna right now for this repeater that we can connect it to. It's temporarily, and I think temporarily, down. I don't know the situation of the future of the 1.2 gig repeater. I don't know what the plans are, because I've been hearing different reports over time of are we going to be needing the repeater? Do we still want to keep it? Do we want to use it? Are people interested in it? And so on. I have not been active on it myself, so I can't confirm that. So, to be perfectly honest, I don't have a direct answer, but right now the repeater is down because of the antenna situation, and the repeater still has to be looked at, which is that in my possession. So there has really been no rush on this up to this point, unless some people are desperate to get back on the air and use it. That's a club decision, which I'm just echoing to you. So if I make any sense, so maybe I don't make any sense saying what I'm saying, it's down. It will be down for a while. I don't know when it'll be back. I don't know what the status is with the antenna, what they're going to be doing. I think that's the best I can tell you. Back to you.
Thank you, Andy. We're getting information from the horse's mouth, the people who are really going to be doing the work in the future. So, Bob, it looks like it's going to be a while. When it comes to the scratchy noises you've been hearing in the past, I've been hearing all kinds of discussion on that. I think people are misunderstanding how it comes about. A station master-like antenna consists of a large number of pieces of semi-rigid coax cable, a quarter-inch diameter semi-rigid coax cable, each a half wavelength long, alternated between center conductor and outer conductor, and they're all connected together in series, and there's some foam material packed around that, and then that all sits inside of the fiberglass radome, and the whole antenna is something like 18 feet tall, mounted from the bottom. Or an 18-foot tall antenna mounted from the bottom in at a 650-foot high altitude on top of a building in Queens, where the wind up there can be really fierce. That antenna is going to be waving in the breeze. So it's only a matter of time before one of those solder joints develops an extremely small crack in the solder between the sections. When the antenna swings back and forth, the smallest amount of scratchiness of that solder connection because it's got a slight crack in it will make sidebands. In order for a repeater to be transmitting and receiving on the same antenna, you need 100 dB of isolation or more between the transmit signal and the receive signal. Let me drop. And let's see, let's assume your transmit signal is 50 watts, which is what, plus 57 dBm, and you want 100 dB of isolation, so you want the signal coming back from the antenna to be minus 50 dBm or weaker, if you know what I mean. And with that small amount of a crack on the side of the antenna when it sways in the breeze, you will be generating a side load that's less than 50 dB down from your transmit signal. You'll be generating a side lobe 600 KC away on the receive frequency. A local transmitter, broadcast transmitter being nearby is an aggravating factor. It's adding more signal to the crack, making noise. But I think there's a 90% chance, Andy, when you go up there and you swing the antenna by pushing it from the base so that it swings back and forth, north and south and then east and west, while the transmitter is on the air, while a weak signal is coming into the repeater. Have somebody give you a weak signal, keyed out, while you swing it back and forth. And you will hear those crackly sounds coming from the antenna. Once you confirm it's the antenna, and all station master-like antennas mounted that way on a high building, it's only a matter of time before they develop the scratchies. It's always going to happen. It's just a matter of how long it takes to happen. The only way you can avoid that is to mount the antenna in such a way that the top of the antenna is captured with some kind of an insulating rod, so that it's no longer able to swing. Because if it swings, it's a matter of time before it develops this fatigue failure. Does that make some sense, Andy? WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Yes, yes. We're going to look into that, but I have another complete different theory. And if you... I didn't want to get into a discussion of my thoughts. It might cause a conflict, but if you want, I can tell you what I think it's coming from and what's causing it.
I think I've heard that some people think that there's an intermediate third antenna that's aggravating the factor, and it's doing some swaying. Possible, but very unlikely. When you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna, within that antenna itself, you want the reflection coefficient 600 KC down to be... You'd like it to be more than 100 dB down. That is a severe requirement. A third antenna in the mix, even if the antenna is only 2 feet away, you've got 20 or 30 dB of loss between the first antenna and the second antenna. And the possibility of the second antenna swaying, making the scratchies, not impossible, but nowhere near as likely. There's a much higher probability it is within your own station master antenna. But go ahead and give me your other theory, Andy. Now's a good time to hear it. WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Okay. In regard to what I believe occurred, and again, don't quote me because I was not at the site. I was not up there at the time this happened. A second VHF antenna has been mounted not far away from this antenna that we're using now, a completely separate antenna with a separate feed line. And I believe that feed line and that second antenna mount is where the 1296 antenna was and was replaced with another VHF station master similar to the one that we're using. You got that so far?
Yes, and that second VHF antenna, maybe it's also a station master-like antenna. Is it operating another repeater, Randy? Go ahead.
The second VHF antenna is not being used right now. My understanding is it's a spare antenna. That antenna and feed line was substituted for the one we're using now as a test to see if the cracklies would disappear, and they did not. The same thing occurred with the other complete antenna on a complete different location with a complete different mount and a complete different feed line. Same result.
There's a high probability, Andy, that both of them are station masters and both have the crackleys. All station master antennas mounted in a place like the top of that building with high wind. It's just a matter of time before they develop the cracklies. There's a high probability both the antennas on a windy day both have the cracklies. Over to you, Andy.
There is. But until we find out which this week we are going to be going up there and making some tests, make some definitive tests to figure out what's exactly going on, I don't want to just say something and speculate. It's this, it's that, it could be this, it could be that. So, at this point, I will drop the subject only because I'm not going to just guess what it is and what's causing it. I hear what you're saying. I will give you more information next week once we have a schedule to go up there this Thursday. Right now, a tentative schedule. Okay, just to let you know, to meet with the manager of the site. Once we find out the information, I will give you the results as a report. Right now, I don't have any answer. I don't know. I'm not sure. And I just don't want to just guess. Okay, so we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah, I'm discussing the physics of the situation, Andy. Within the antenna that we're transmitting on right now, you need ridiculous isolation between transmit and receive, 600 KC away, not to be creating interference to the receiver. That other station master antenna, no matter how bad it is, at some number of feet away, not connected to a transmitter, the chances of it, I mean, the signal flowing from the first antenna to the second antenna is going to experience, let me pick a number, a 20 dB insertion loss, a 10 dB insertion loss. The chances of the second antenna's cracklies giving you the cracklies that we're hearing on our antenna, very unlikely. My prediction is that when you go up there and swing our antenna with your hand, let it swing back and forth, north and south, then east and west, while a weak signal is coming through the input, you're going to find cracklies on our antenna. You do the exact same swinging of the second antenna that's connected to nothing, you will not find correlation. The chances of it doing it, you don't get a disconnect and connect on the antenna that bad. If you were putting a screwdriver across the connector at the bottom of that second antenna and making and breaking contact, yes, that could do it. But that's a severe situation of an antenna some number of feet away. For that to happen within the antenna itself when it's swaying, very unlikely. That's what I predict you're going to find, Andy. And so when you swing the two and you find the cracklies on our antenna and not on the other, you'll be getting a pretty strong confirmation. Does that make some sense? W2SAY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yes. I'm not, yeah, I understand. I got it. We're going to be doing all that, exactly what you say. We're going to be making a bunch of different tests, and I have some notes here that I wrote down of things that we want to do. So we're going to be doing that, and the physics I understand. So I will let you know, since I have no more information to tell you, what I just mentioned, until we do it. So once we get it done, then I'll let you know what we find, and I expect to see exactly what you said. Let's see if it's true.
Now, because the cracklies are always inevitable with a base-mounted station master-like antenna at a high location, it's just a matter of time before you get the cracklies. There's got to be a way of binding the top of the antenna. That gives us two or three possibilities. Number one, agree to allow the antenna to be moved even to a less desirable location where you can have a rod coming out of from some kind of a structure, grabbing the top of the antenna, stopping it from swaying. That's one solution. Another solution would be literally to put some Dacron guying ropes on the tip of the current antenna. Three Dacron guying ropes down to the floor or down to anything to stop the antenna from swaying would work. And I know it sounds a little bit hokey, but if they would allow you to put a U-bolt on top with three pieces of Dacron black rope acting as guying so the antenna can no longer sway, it would stop the antenna from developing the crackies in the future, cracklies in the future. K2KN, here we go. W2CDL, K2RIW, go ahead, Andy.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I'm one of those calls. Yeah. Yes, I got you. That's another possibility. Yes, something from stopping the antenna from moving and swaying back and forth. We know it happens in the wind. We know that. We've heard it, and it's got a rhythmic sound to it. I'm sure that people have noticed that. You can hear it sound very rhythmic as the wind blows, as something is moving back and forth and up and down and swaying and so on. So we got that. All right. Listen, I gotta go. As you say, so you could continue the tech net, and I'll be listening in the background. I gotta finish up. I'm doing some work on the computer, but I just wanted to answer the question since it was brought up regarding 1296 and everything else. So we will get to the bottom of this. The bottom line is the problem will be solved, and we'll be back to a good clean sounding repeater. I guarantee that. I have complete confidence in the people that we're with, and we'll get everything fixed up for sure. So thanks, Dick. I'll give it back to you. WHCDO.
WHOSAY.
Doug recognized. Yeah, the cyclic burst of noise is a very strong confirmation of swaying in the wind, particularly when it happens on a windy day. When you think about that, Andy, it's a very strong confirmation. I'm 90% sure that when you sway the antenna with your hand, you're going to find confirmation. So the HUSAY, go ahead, Doug, K2RAW.
Following the discussion here, I wonder why you could not use a 4-inch diameter piece of plastic pipe what do you call it? I can't think of the word now. You know, to protect the antenna from blowing around in the wind. You get a big piece of this PVC pipe with a cap on the top of it, stick the antenna up inside the thing, and then the wind is not going to affect it at all. A radome, that's the word I was looking for. Yes, why use a piece of plastic pipe as a radome?
That would help, but it wouldn't be enough, Doug. First of all, that PVC pipe along the whole length of an 18-foot-long station master would detune it. So your beautiful tuning, where it's got a great notch in its planning wave ratio at your desired frequency, it's going to go away when you put it inside the pipe. On top of that, your 18-foot-long piece of PVC pipe suspended from the bottom, it's also going to sway. It's not going to sway quite as much. But your radome is also going to sway. The only way to really stop it from swaying, you've got to find some way of binding the top of it. If it was a side-mounted antenna on a tower, it's a simple matter to bring a dielectric rod out at right angles from the tower and clamp it with a U-bolt onto the top of the station master. That stops it from swaying. I know of an installation on Long Island where a side-mounted antenna like that was put up 10 years ago, and it's behaving beautifully today because it's properly supported. So the 18-foot-long station master with its fiberglass radome, it's only got a finite life if you're putting it in a windy location and mounting it just from the base. It's only a matter of time before it's going to give you a failure. So your PVC pipe is a step in the right direction, but it's got a couple of nasty disadvantages, and it wouldn't be a complete solution, in my opinion, Doug. WHOSAY, K2RAW.
Okay, it was just a suggestion. I didn't realize it was 18 feet long, but I guess if you had a fairly large diameter piece of PVC, I don't know how big they make it, but it would be fairly rigid. You might have to support the top of it, as you mentioned before, with guy lines of some sort. Anyway, just an idea. Back to that, and I'll be clear off just listening.
Question in one way to way.
Hank recognized. Hopefully, they'll either move the antenna to a place where they can put a support rod out from the building, so to speak, or find some other way of guiding it. But we've got to stop the top of the antenna from swaying. Otherwise, this problem is always going to keep coming back. Every couple of years, you're going to have cracklies. You've got it, Hank, K2RAW.
Are Are the cracklies, as you call them, caused by the radome on fiberglass of the antenna actually cracking itself and developing some kind of fissures in the wind?
Not impossible, Hank, but very unlikely. People who have actually taken apart a station master that gives them the cracklies, when they looked at it under a microscope, they almost always will find one of the multiple solder joints between all of those pieces. You got a whole bunch of half-wavelength long chunks of a quarter-inch diameter semi-rigid cable with an alternating center conductor and outer conductor on each junction. You got a whole bunch of these in series. And so one of those develops a very fine hairline crack in the solder joint. And that hairline crack, when it's being... you know what would happen if you had two screwdrivers held in front of your handy-talkie while doing a reception of a weak signal, and you scratch the two screwdrivers against each other. The intermittent contact you get between the two screwdrivers would create static that you would hear on your handy-talkie. So when it's within the antenna itself, an extremely fine crack being swayed in the wind makes a small change in the conductivity of that junction. That junction only has to change by milliohms of conductivity in order to create a scratchy junction that will create a side lobe 600 kc away from the transmitter signal on the receive signal, a side lobe that's 600 kc away that's less than 100 dB down. That's a offending crackly signal that now disturbs the sensitivity of your weak signal reception. Are you getting the picture of that one, Hank? Over to you, Hank, K2IW.
Yes, I am, Dick, and thanks for the explanation. Next silly question is, can you slide the radiator out from the existing radome and repair it, or is it one of those things that once you open it up, you've destroyed it?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that. There are various versions of the station master antenna where you can open it up at the bottom and slide everything out. There are other versions where it's filled up with poured wax. People have tried melting out all of that wax, an ugly procedure. So depending on which method of construction yours has, it may or may not be repairable. I think some people do send them back to the factory. I think it is repairable at the factory. Can we hams do it ourselves? It's a matter of the method of construction of your particular antenna. And so that radome around it, with the ultraviolet exposure in the wind being continuously being flexed, it eventually becomes more flexible in time. So a base-mounted station master on a windy location, just a matter of time before it's almost always going to give you a failure of this kind. Over to you, Hank, K2RAW.
All right, thank you very much. 1YDY is clear.
Yeah, a lot of people have trouble envisioning how a tiny hairline crack in a solder joint in the middle of an antenna can create such grief. But when you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna, you're requesting an extremely strong amount of isolation between transmit signal and receive signal. You need more than 100 dB. You'd like 120 dB of isolation, which means you want all side lobes from the transmitting signal 600 kc away to be 120 dB down, not to be creating desensitization. That's a severe requirement. A modulation index that's so small you couldn't even measure it on the transmit signal because of that crackly joint, the joint with the hairline crack, changing the insertion loss by a hundredth of a dB in an intermittent manner can create the noise that we're talking about because it's such a severe requirement. Split antennas where you transmit out of one and receive out of the other gives you ridiculous amounts of non-vulnerability to this particular problem. But then when you've got two antennas, one transmitting and one receiving, you've always got a little bit of a problem now of the patterns don't quite match. So in some locations, the antenna is going to be an alligator. In other places, it's going to be a rabbit. In other words, it's either going to have in certain directions better sensitivity on receive than transmit and vice versa. So to have everything all back packed into one antenna is nice if you get away with it, but it requires strong mechanical support at the top of the station master antenna not to be creating this problem. Okay, so I think you got your answer with reference to the 1200 megacycle repeater, Bob, looks like it's going to be a while. K2RL double for any, RLW for any final comments. K2RIW, over to you, Bob.
K2RIW, K2RLW here. Okay, well, thanks a lot for the discussion. And my interest is there. Is there any other activity on 1296 that I could listen for? Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, in the past, I knew of particular guys who had 1296 rigs at their home with antennas. Every one of them that I know has moved away or become a silent key. So, let me pass it out to the net. Does anybody know of anybody in the tri-state area active on 1296 at this time? If you know of anybody on 1296 at this time, give me your call letter right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, it takes a rare guy to go on 1296. W2CQH, Reed Fisher, was one of them, but he has retired to Georgia. K2UWC, I think it was Uncle Willie Charlie in Hempstead. He's become a silent key. Each of the guys I know on 1296 have either become silent keys or moved away. It takes a rare guy to go up that high. When you go up that high in frequency, you get a nosebleed, Bob. So, I wonder if ARRL has a way of answering the question. I wonder if there's a way you can launch a signal into a website somewhere, like QRZ.com. Is there a way you can launch a signal there saying, is anybody in the tri-state area on 1296? You'd like to hear somebody talk back to your rig. So there's got to be a way of getting in contact with people. So don't give up, Bob. And as I said, it takes a fairly progressive guy to get up there. All right, we're going to go over to Rich next. It'll be B2GXM, K2RIW. You got it, Rich.
K2RIW in the group. Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. This is Rich. Dick, you've entertained questions about heating systems in the past. So here is another one. I have a natural gas boiler. And I know that there's electricity connections which turn it on and off or whatever. I'm not sure how the heating system uses its electricity, but my question is there some way to connect battery power to use the natural gas boiler in case the main power goes out during the winter? WB2GXM.
Yeah, I think there is a 24-volt transformer alongside of your heating system that goes to the thermostat. When the thermostat is commanding heat, it's closing contacts, applying the 24 or 28-volt signal to the valve mechanism at the furnace. That, in turn, allows the gas to flow to light the flame if and only if the pilot light and that safety mechanism is saying that, yes, the pilot light is lit, the pilot light heat is creating a heating of a bimetallic strip or whatever it is, a thermal sensor, enabling the system. The system is enabled by the pilot light creating heat. So a 24-volt signal, AC signal or DC signal, to the actual valve. Now, the guy I know who has actually experimented with this is Into APG, Dave. Into APG, I think he has established a method of firing his gas supply, his gas-fired furnace, when the power is out. Let's see if NPG is on frequency. Into APG, are you there, Dave? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, Into APG.
Okay, I think you have established a method of turning on your furnace when the power is off in your house so that you can get heat. Is that true? And how have you done it? And I'll bet you've done it with standby batteries and your own control circuit. You've got it, Dave. Yeah, Roger. Just a quick question from the person inquiring. I didn't catch his name. Do you have a steam system? Steam heat?
That name is Rich. GXM, go ahead, Rich.
Dave, affirmative. My heating system is steam heat fired by the natural gas boiler.